been using half a dozen typefaces for the last decade. I'm sick of all of them. Everyone else is sick of them. And they're, you know, collectively, they are as expressive as a blank wall.
Welcome back to the First Crack Podcast. I am, yet again, Garrick Van Buren. This is First Crack Podcast number 124, a discussion on font licensing, open fonts, and web fonts with Ben Weiner from readingtype.org.uk. Ben's got a number of fonts that he's released under the Open Font license. He's also a member of the OpenFontLibrary.org team. Theme music by Jeremy Feller. For more podcasts just like this one, firstcrackpodcast.com. Let's get started.
I put the proposal there because I thought that even if someone came along and stole it, well, you know, that would be kind of useful. What I've become aware of in the meantime is that the theoretically, at least, the process of getting hold of basically applying web fonts to your site for an ignorant designer is now a matter of going to a website and sort of throwing the font files at it. It seems I haven't really tried, but there's some smart work being done, and that made me think again about whether it was a complex enough topic to merit someone writing about it properly. I mean, the advantage is that if you write a book, then you think about what you're saying, and you should knit the topics together, and you should balance things off. The disadvantage, of course, is that it's a book. So, you know, it just seemed like a proposition worth making.
And I thought it was. I think it was a good stake in the ground to make. To me, it seems like there's a lot of good work that still needs to happen in this space. From a longer-term perspective.
Oh, yeah.
The work that you were doing and maybe still are doing on the Open Font Library and the work that you're doing with your fonts themselves seems to me like better long-term work.
Yeah, well, I mean, okay. There's a bit of ideology and a bit of politics and a bit of pragmatism in there, which is a good mix, I suppose. So, in reverse order, the pragmatism first. The pragmatism is that when I was a student, then I had some spare time, and I had the time to play around with Fontographer and make some fonts. And it takes a very, very, very long time indeed. And what you do at first is absolute rubbish, but if you've got the right kind of obsessive mentality, then it's very compelling. Most of that work was done a decade ago, or maybe.
And if I could just... a couple of clarifying points on that. Were you at the Reading School or for type or whatever that's
correct. Yeah. The typography department in the University of Reading.
Great.
So
that you were a student there like a decade ago, and are the fonts that you put together during your time there the ones that are available at your site currently?
Broadly speaking, yes. At that time and soon after, the subtle point is that, in fact, although you could do a short course as an undergraduate in type design, then I didn't do that course because actually I wanted to get on with it and I didn't want anyone to see what I was doing until I'd finished because I thought, you know, this is my little hobby thing and I don't want it crushed. I didn't show it around until I'd done I don't know how many hours work on it. That worked out quite well for me in the end because although I got a kind of the most minimal compliment you could possibly imagine out of Gerard Unger, who I showed it to. I mean, he's a serious font designer with decades of experience. Then I also wrote up the work that I'd done and that made a neat little student project and did well for me. So that was cool. And really that's what I wanted. I wanted to try it and see what it was like. And, you know, I had this free copy of Fontographer, let's play with it. Let's give it a go. And the key thing was, of course, I couldn't afford to buy the fonts that I liked. And, you know, students around the world, just copy fonts. We were doing it then, they're doing it now. I mean, et cetera, et cetera. Here's a bit of idealism mixed in with that. I thought maybe I could give it a crack and see what it would take to do it, do it for myself. And I guess I'm just lucky that I use Latin characters when I communicate, and those are easy.
And, you know, since then we've gotten, and since then Fontographer doesn't really exist anymore, if memory serves correctly. And we've got other things that are at least as expensive as Fontographer once was. And we also have something like FontForge today. I'm guessing that the level of complexity and the level of just get, you know, dig in and do the work is about the same in whatever these tools are.
That's true. I mean, there are other avenues that you can explore in trying to make the work easier. I mean, you spread it out, which is fairly uncommon. At least it's uncommon to go to more than a few people. Or you make tools that are smart. And a lot of work's been done by a lot of very gifted people to make some of the really, really boring stuff much, much easier. And for example, FontLab is scriptable. And then there are lots of other tools by smart people, most of them in the Netherlands, that make these things, you know, kind of child's play and give a designer loads of scope just to trial stuff and pick what they like and explore those permutations more. But the core business of actually sitting down and going, right, well, I want this letter to look like this. I mean, that will always be the same task, and you'll always have to do it in broadly the same way, whether you use a pencil or whether you go straight to, you know, plotting it with a mouse, which is what I did.
The fonts that you have up at your site today are licensed under the Open Font license?
Correct. Yeah.
That's one of many licenses that you and the rest of the team behind the Open Font library are accepting for inclusion within the Open Font library. Can you tell me your thoughts on the criteria for choosing that specific license for your work, and broadly speaking, the thought process for which fonts are going that are included in the Open Font library or accepted, acknowledged by the Open Font library?
The first of those questions is really, really easy to answer. I mean, that license didn't exist when I made my fonts, and I just stuck them on the web because I didn't really care. I didn't have anything to lose. And when the license came along, I applied it so that, you know, there are plenty of, notionally, there could be plenty of copies of that font floating around on the web that don't have the OFL license on them. But, you know, at the time when I applied the license, I went through and tidied them up a little bit and stuff like that. So it was easy for me because I'd already decided that these were going to be freely available. So stick the license on. The license says these are freely available and you're not allowed to unmake them freely available. That's great. The other reason for the OFL license being good is that it was written for fonts, and there aren't any other free Libre licenses that are like that.
And I know there was like some confusion or some lack of clarity around how the GPL handled fonts as well. So, and I think that's the OFL, in my understanding, is somewhat of a clarification or reaction to that lack of clarity.
That's true. And the debate continues. I mean, there simply isn't one open source, one free software license. There never will be. There never could be. And fonts are just a microcosm of that. So, you know, there's all kinds of little avenues you go down with dual licensing and all those kind of clever things that get people out of holes. It's always going to be a bit difficult. There will never be a consensus within the open font library community. There's no center to that community. It's amorphous. It'll come and go and change. In fact, there's very little discussion evident at the moment on the list. It's pretty much dead. So what it really represents is kind of, I suppose, a consensus on the best accommodation of ideals and reality. And last time I looked, I think that the Open Font Library was going to say basically, oh, what do we have? I think we had three licenses. I think we had the OFL in its current iteration, the GPL version 3+, I guess, with the font exception. I can't remember if that was going to be officially supported, and also MIT. The thing is that the Open Font Library has a more important goal than kind of promulgating, you know, different licenses. Its main goal is to get typefaces out there, get permissively licensed fonts out into the community and being used as best as possible. Now, if you look at the site at the moment, you'll see we have a few other problems with getting that goal achieved. We don't really need complicated licensing making it worse. So I think what the general feeling is amongst people who've been discussing it is that what we need to do is be as clear as we can on the face of it, and then deal with the exceptions as they arise in the most accommodating way we can. So by discourse, talking to authors, talking to projects who are generating fonts. I mean, we should have copies of things like, you know, the free Droid fonts, for example, should be available there, because there's no reason why they shouldn't be. But they're under a different license. I think they're under... They under the Apache license or something?
Yeah, I was just checking at that, and I believe they are under Apache.
Yeah, so you know, so what we've got here is a user experience branding sort of that's what's going on. That's what the job of the Open Font Library ought to be, and not to be kind of mega font police. So that's why there's a need to be quite dumb. And I don't think anyone, there may be a few people on that list that can hold in their head the twists and turns of what's going on with font licensing and you know, alternatives to OFL. But right now, what we have is a license which was written for designers, for font vendors.
Yeah, and that's, and again, you know, when I said, hey, Ben, I'd love to talk about font license with you, with all the challenges and controversy and heated discussion that's happening in the font world, it really boils down to that specific issue, and I think OFL seemed to solve it pretty well, and by doing something that, from my perspective, helps everybody all the way around in terms of recognizing licenses that are like MIT and like the GPL that are well known outside of the font community. It seems to me like the type designers and people with font IP have had a history of writing up extremely custom specific licenses, which you know, web designers don't really have a familiarity with for all sorts of reasons. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's true. And you ask anyone whether they know the terms on which they're allowed to use fonts that they've either, well, you know, all you have to do is look in people's font folders, whatever platform they're on. I mean, go have a look and ask them. They won't know. I mean, I've got all kinds of fonts floating around that I can't work out where they came from. I have to go all the way back through the chain and figure it out if I really want to know, which I don't, because I just want to use it. I don't know what your experience is, what you picked up from the commercial end of the font world, you know, the proper grown up big boy world is. But they are, as far as I can tell, they're very concerned about that. But unfortunately, they also have a habit of running around in small circles. And there's a lovely project which was initiated basically by Tiffany Wardle in 2004, I think. I was just having a little dig around on the web to see if I could find out more. And I was having a look at let me see if I can remind myself what the website's called. But it's something like eeulaa.org. And what it's trying to do, let me see if I can find it. Okay, it's trying to present some kind of consolidation of the thinking about how to make licenses, end-user license agreements we're talking about here. So these are for proprietary fonts. How to make them kind of universalized so that they can be understood at a glance. Now, you could argue, if you were being puckish and you were being an advocate of kind of free software, permissively licensed software, you could say, well, you know, you might as well piss in the wind. Because it is complicated and these guys want money because they've worked. So they've got a problem sorting that out. If they can do it better, then that's great. But it's quite a small community. Lawyers and advice is quite expensive. You need case law and all kinds of stuff to untangle it and figure it out and, you know, test the theory and all the rest. In the past, the font vendors have come out badly when they've tried to use legislation. So this is probably, well, I don't know. I guess it's not going to move very quickly. And it's no help to people who want to sell type for use in web browsers, for example, sell licenses.
Right, which is one of the reasons why, even though we've had the capability for quite a while now, we haven't seen any usage
That's right.
At all, yeah. Yeah. They'll ask me about, you know, Linotype or Adobe or big places like that supporting web use. I'm like, well, I don't see it happening very quickly, and it's been a decade, so try somebody
else.
Right.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, what got me going again on this topic? I mean, I remember, as you probably do, when the EOT, when that came out, and in fact the Netscape one as well, which the name of which escapes me. I was really excited because I was a designer and I liked typefaces, and I thought, right, you know, here we go. And I never succeeded in getting either of them to work. I didn't really understand what was required. I could dimly perceive that there was going to be some problems. But then it all died down and went quiet. And it was really only the deliberate, provocative work done by, presumably by Apple, that's got the whole thing moving again. Mm-hmm. And I'm very grateful to Apple for doing that. I mean, they've been extremely quiet in the debate. I mean, I don't have great lines into their kind of strategic thinking, and I think that if there's anyone on the planet that does, that then you know, we probably don't, none of us know it. They've deliberately pushed the agenda right onwards by effectively ignoring those restrictions. Now, Apple, of course, distributes font files. It has license agreements with, you know, other foundries, but it's just kind of gone for it, which is very Apple. Now, the result of that is that you then have everyone else wanting to join in the fun. And it was when that was starting to happen, and I was kind of poking about with at font face rules again and going, right, well, okay, so, you know, this thing will actually let me just use a regular TrueType font, then that's what got me thinking again about the Open Font Library and the fact that, you know, there was this system. Now, of course, it's no good for proprietary stuff, but it would be cool if it would make it possible for those permissively licensed fonts to be used directly. So that's what got things rolling again. And then we saw, of course, we saw Firefox pick up the baton and Opera too. So, you know, that's how it worked. It was a huge gap with pointlessness in it, and then someone just decided to ignore the rules and just go for it. And you just needed someone to make that step.
Yes, yeah, I concur, and that pretty much echoes my path back into this topic as well. And I think that, you know, what we have today is, as we have had, you know, since the history of browsers, is everybody interpreting that functionality and capability a little bit differently,
right?
Yeah, and I'm not sure how the decade plus old, you know, web designer is me like, oh, I don't know how WAF is going to solve this problem, but at least from a rearview mirror perspective, until everybody supports one thing perspective, we still have this multi-format issue. Which what have you? We have that in all other sorts of assets anyway. So what have?
Well,
you?
That's true. Yeah. I mean, I'm happy to stick my neck out because I have nothing much to lose, and say that I think that Microsoft will be supporting that format in the future. But there's a whole the licensing stuff really still isn't exactly there. I don't think they've got any problems with it, because if you look at WAF, then WAF is just, you know, EOT without DRM, you know, and it's the same. Technically, there's very little difference, so it's easy for them to say, yeah, that's cool, but they've still got to work out how they deal with the rest of it, and that's just a cultural issue for them, really.
Yeah, and I think that this is what I've saying since the sort of round two of At Font Face has started, is that, you know, we've solved the technology problems. We still haven't solved the legal problems effectively, right? If I don't understand how my license works today with my desktop fonts, I'm not sure that by putting that license in a different place in the font file is going to make me acknowledge it anymore.
Right. Okay. But of course, what you don't know, and what, you know, this putative book could explain, is that if you have a font on your computer right now, you can't, unless it's a permissively licensed one, you can't upload it. You can't use it. I mean, you haven't got anywhere. That those assets that you thought you might be able to repurpose ain't going nowhere unless you want to have a Font Foundry try out some, you know, legal stuff on you.
And I think to some degree, is that not what the Microsoft's really old and dusty weft tool was supposed to help expose?
Yes, it kind of was, although you would have to have a license that allowed you to, I think what they thought at the time was that embedding would be how it, you know, how it distinguished, you know, and if the embedding bit was set so that you could theoretically embed the font in a Word document or a PDF, then that would be okay. But no one really tried it, to be honest. And there was a lot of debate on the list about, you know, that particular point on the WW fonts list. And really, the answers were vague, a lot of shrugging of shoulders, basically, and people didn't know. And it doesn't really make any difference anyway, because that was then and this is now. And if that solution wasn't a solution, I mean, it was a solution looking for a problem, really, EOT version 1.
Yes.
The problem that it was set to address didn't exist, and the problem that did exist, it didn't address. So, you know, total failure. Not that I'm criticizing the earnest efforts of the people that thought it might be worth try back in the day. You know, I'm sure it gave them a lot of insight, but, you know, we've just crawled over that ground again, and we haven't seen anything new, and they haven't told us anything useful. So, you know, bye-bye to that one, I think, is the bottom line. But, you know, because fonts that designers have on their computers now are totally invalid, then that is an opportunity. I mean, it's an opportunity for anyone that thinks they can monetize their font collections in a different way, because they know that the only fonts that are going to fly legally are ones that they make available now. And, I mean, I haven't dug very deeply into it, but I know that you have vendors like FontShop offering, what, 20 different fonts? Is that right? Something like that. Mm-hmm. So they're ready to see what happens. The king of this market, well, there are a couple of kings, but one of them is Jules Spivinger, who's a Dutch guy. I probably pronounced his name wrong. Balvinger? I don't know. Anyway, the point is that he makes his basic designs available for free, and I believe a few of them are licensed for web use. And if you want the rest, then you've got to talk to him. Mm-hmm. And that's a great entree, because he's, you know, quotes, giving away stuff, but he's hoping for a return. Now, those fonts are not permissively licensed in any way. But if people want to come along and establish projects or perhaps redirect projects that are aimed at getting, say, minority use typefaces out into the world, then they're free to do it. And in fact, the thing about that is, as you rather implied, that the license already allows that. There's no need to revisit anything. I mean, it says, do what you will with this, just don't sell it in its current form, because you're not allowed to, and don't claim that it's yours, because it's not yours. You can use it as much as you like, but it was created by me, and that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's very important for, you know, basically, open source licenses are great things, and as long as people play along, everybody benefits in some way, and it's up to the originator how they choose to make that benefit manifest to themselves if it's there. I mean, people like me have done something essentially for the pleasure of it, and that's the benefit that we choose to reap. But, you know, there are other ways through the woods.
Right, and what I think is most interesting is it doesn't releasing something under that license doesn't preclude you for a font designer or anyone from making money during the creation process of something they've released under it. And that's the part that sort of, as I'm working more with Kernest, and I'm seeing that that's where, you know, following the money, right? There's, I think the retail price tags for fonts, whether they be web use or otherwise, are just too small to be sustainable, to grow. Mm-hmm. If we said, hey, I want to become a professional font designer, that's all I want to do, I'm not gonna make the money on selling one off web use licenses, right? There's gotta be somewhere else that I make the bulk of my income from. And if what license does make sense that would more accurately reflect where I'm getting my income from. So.
Yeah. That sounds right. And I mean, in discussions with Dave Crossland, who is another who's just graduated from the Reading MA in typeface design and has some strong opinions about things. Now he'd been sort of chewing over this one for a while and thinking about whether he could do something with it, you know, perhaps act as a kind of a figurehead for a small group of people doing some kind of subscription services or, you know, originating fonts that would then later be licensed, you know, permissively, but would initially have sort of subscribers paying for them and all kinds of cute ideas. And they're all out there. And I think what you're saying is that if there's a permissive license in play, then it sort of frees things up a bit because it's easier to deal with. It's everyone knows what's supposed to be going on, and that still doesn't mean that you can't have a group of kind of diehards that want the latest one or whatever it is. You know, there's value added stuff to be put on there. I mean, what the I forget the name of the service that's just come in the last few days. I don't think it's something which you initiated, but it could be. let me just have a little look at my link. But that commoditizes the knowledge, and it brings us back to the book. You see, if the knowledge of how to generate the things is commoditized, I'm afraid it's another service you can't really reprovide, as it were. But you can do sort of load. You can do sort of load optimization or you know, reduce the load by offering the opportunity to cache fonts on a different server or whatever it is. So there are still things that third party hosters can offer over and above the actual, you know, just supplying vector outlines. Mm-hmm. Let me just have a look at the where did I put the little link comments? Blah 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 blah. Yeah, Font Squirrel.
Yes.
So what FontSquirrel does is, on the assumption that your font is legally, you know, you've been licensed it in a way that lets you use it, then it takes away any of the, theoretically, I mean, I haven't really tried it, it takes away any of the complications of actually figuring out what you're supposed to do to write in that font face rule. Now, they're not very hard, but there are a few wrinkles in them. I believe that, yeah, what I've got here is a thing which is offering me EOTs and SVGs and some other cute stuff with auto hinting, which I mean, I've no idea exactly what's going on there, but that's really nice, and that's saying, well, you know, you have the font file, let's move on over the licensing difficulty right now. Let's set you up with all the kind of infrastructure you need to serve that font out. Mm-hmm. But that's one way through, and the sort of poster boys of this are probably Typekit, and they're not offering that kind of service at all, and I'm sure FontShop are not either. So, you know, there are ways.
That conversion and optimization process you're talking about?
Yeah, because they're not doing that. They're saying, well, we've got the fonts. We know how the fonts work. You know, you get them from us, and that's it. You don't take them away. Mm-hmm. But there's so many ways through, and depending on what those ways are, then your theory probably is more or less influential. You know, your theory about the license and about there being space for people who want to have a go at permissive licensing and you know, try things out. But yes, obviously, if the typeface is licensed permissively, then on the face of it, you don't make money out of it. Mm-hmm. On the face of it, I think their organization of the way that a typeface gets turned into a sort of a font nicely packaged is, I mean, that's really well understood. That's a well-trodden path, and the way in which they stay alive is, to a certain extent, a well-trodden path as well. But it's not it's not paved with gold.
Mm-hmm. So, are you drawing up new faces right now, or it's basically the ones that you've drawn up historically? The reason I bring this up, there's an open Baskerville project that's up on GitHub.
And right.
Are you involved in that? Are you familiar with that project?
I know of it. Okay. I haven't delved into it. I think it's quite a cute idea, mm-hmm. but it's one of the edge paths, as it were. It's one of the paths along the edge of the precipice. I would like to see it succeed, but I don't know that it will. its past is a bit tangled up, and its future is probably a little bit uncertain as well. It seems to have picked up the output of an earlier project that sort of didn't quite complete, and I think that's great and that's expedient, but it doesn't offer us a model for anything else if that's the case.
Dive into that a little bit. I'm not tracking.
I can't go very far into it, but I believe that the outlines were donated by another project which had run its course.
Oh, okay. So they already had a pretty significant foundation laid to build this on top of. And so you're saying because of that, it doesn't really solve the problem of how to get those initial outlines.
Right. Gotcha. And that may be a travesty, and I apologize if so, and anyone is welcome to correct me. But I think that if you go and read through some of the discussion around it, the outlines were pre-existing. And, of course, this probably brings us to another and much sort of safer way of generating fonts on the cheap, and that is, of course, that we have a device called a scanner, and we have a commercial mechanism known as copyright. And in different jurisdictions, in different parts of the world, then if you take a printed letter that exists somewhere and you slap it down on a scanner and you generate outlines from that, you're either breaking someone's copyright or not. And that is a traditional way for people to monetize the past, basically. And the older your original source is, the more likely that you're in the clear. And it's a matter of doing a lot of cleaning and tidying, but that's it. Now, there is some really nice stuff that's come through that route, and there's lots of opportunity for more, because a whole load of people spent a long time stooped double over kind of magnifying glasses, chipping away at bits of metal and making really beautiful typefaces, and they did it a long time ago. And all that stuff's out there, and there are commercial equivalents, but that doesn't stop you. I mean, you know, go talk to the commercial foundries about the whole business of typefaces that look very, very, very similar indeed, but aren't quite. You know, there's lots of stories there, because it's a sore point. But
right. The whole reason that you would create Arial is because you don't feel like paying for Helvetica. Right.
Well, yeah, indeed. I mean, there are some other drivers there as well, but yeah, a fascinating typeface, that one. Here's an example. The typeface Centaur is probably, of all the ones you could digitize, I mean, that's quite close to being within some kind of copyright somewhere in the world. That's a 1930s typeface, I believe, a monotypeface. And there's a beautiful, not unfinished digitization of that, which has been done from printed materials. I've completely forgotten what it's called, something like Museum. What museum? And that was done, I think that was done by Rafe Levine, I think. Mm-hmm. He has also created some other really great stuff, like, I mean, I don't know how he did this, but he's made a lovely monospace typeface, which he's called Inconsolata.
Beautiful. I'm using it on my site right now. I love it.
Right. Yeah. Now, I think it probably works an awful lot better on a Mac than it does on Windows, but I can't confirm that. I've not looked at it on Windows. The reason being that the Windows team spent many, many years and probably quite a lot of cash making a beautiful renderer for low-grade screens, and now everyone's screens are beautiful. So I don't know where that one's going, but it just doesn't make nice type look nice. It makes it look crap. Whereas the Mac, which sort of has a much more slapdash attitude, creates really nice looking outlines. So, you know, and free TypeScript. So anyway, let's not get into that one. Anyway, so Inconsolata is Franklin Gothic turned into a monospace typeface. And that is a classic use case for openly licensed fonts, permissively licensed fonts, and indeed it is, and you could remix it, you could do stuff with it, as long as you don't call it Inconsolata. I mean, as far as I know, that one's an OFL licensed font. Loads of potential there. I mean, you know, think about those scripts we were talking about earlier. If you open that font up in your favorite font editor that's scriptable and say, right, well, I want this to be really fat or really stretched, or, you know, I want all the curly things to be, you know, convex instead of concave, or concave instead of convex, you can do it.
And based on the scriptability of that application, you could do it very, very quickly and get a starting point for something that you would then go in and, you know, even refine some more to make it a little more beautiful looking.
That's right. You probably would refine it a little bit more. And, you know, there's a whole load of guys who graduated in the last few years from, say, Type and Media in The Hague, which is a pretty fabby master's course, who have spent, by all accounts, every waking hour for the best part of a year learning how to do that kind of thing, along with learning an appreciation of how to generate their own original typefaces. So it's a matter of course for them. I mean, they're you know, there's what, 15, 20, no, let's say, I don't know how many guys go through that in a year, but every year a whole nother load comes out, and they're all equipped with all the tools they need to do that stuff, and to do it efficiently and to do it well, even without having any of their peers around them saying, you know, you screwed that terminal up, that doesn't look right. Sound okay?
Yeah, I was just making a note about I didn't want to lose the bit you were talking about a while back about the Font Squirrel and the downloading kits and giving you the at font face declaration. I didn't want to lose that point, so I just took a moment and jotted that down. I think that's fantastic. And that's one of the things, and when I'm looking at the work that I'm seeing from the University of Reading, is that what's it called, University of Reading? And Type of Media you just described, you know, to me that's that seems to me like the fertile ground, the starting point for a growth in permissibly licensed fonts. You know, people who have got an appreciation of type, that know how it works, that have the technology experience, and are trying to make a name for themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
Good point. And that might help get them over a big hump, because they've also spent a load of time being told that, you know, their work is precious and all the rest of it. They are not in the permissively licensed open source whatever it is, free software. They're not that they have a lot of trouble getting their heads around that. It's a real stumbling block for them.
The students, you're saying, have a hard time getting their heads.
This is not something that I can provide lots of evidence for. But my dear friend Dave Crossland, who I've already alluded to, who's a fanatic for that kind of thing, spent a long time browbeating them. And saying, look, you know, this is a way it could work for you, and they don't like it, and that's really not, it's not surprising, but it's perhaps a bit disappointing. I think that they I think if they find out how the wind's blowing, then that may change overnight. It's difficult. Licensing software is tricky, and it is a road crash going on there between sort of creative instincts and concepts of fair value and reward and all the rest of it. And the fact that, you know, online in particular, the currents move very, very rapidly, and you do kind of want to do what you can to stay on top of things. And opportunities open up and they close quickly. This one is opening actually quite slowly, and there's room to jump in for a whole bunch of people. I don't know. My information is probably not very up to date, but last I heard, then, you know, this was not seen as a great thing in the typeface design student community. So we'll have to see.
No, and based on my browsing of the archives of the work that the students at Reading have done, and the sort of percentage of designers that are making that work available online or otherwise in any shape or form outside of a, hey, download this PDF specimen. That feels consistent and equally surprising. And, you know, I'm spent my career to date has been in, you know, the web design and web programming world, where, you know, the first thing you do after you get some code out is, you know, release it under MIT or a GPL.
Yeah.
And,
right.
And
exactly.
And to see that there's this, it seems to me, a huge opportunity of new work that's not being, from the outset, we're saying, no, we're restricting use on this very, very tightly, almost to the point where, you know, it doesn't really exist if I can't, hey, great, you know, a new font is out, but if I can't use it on my website, it has zero value to me.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, it's kind of a, From I think from your perspective and from mine, it's a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, as soon as I could get at font face working you know, end of story. I was going to have it, you know. I wasn't necessarily going to say, right, well, I'm going to put this really illegible typeface on because I know that I like it and I don't care about you guys. But I was going to try it and I was going to evaluate it and I was going to say, thank God, because, you know, I've been using half a dozen typefaces for the last decade. I'm sick of all of them. Everyone else is sick of them. And they're, you know, collectively, they are as expressive as a blank wall. You know, they are not doing any work. And plus, I'm not having all this image replacement, you know, BS going on because look at it. I mean, it's a horrible hack. And you only have to, you know, you only have to do a little bit of web design to know exactly how many horrible hacks are already floating around, and contributing another few is bad. You know, I mean, I don't wish bad karma on the CIFA guys or anything. I think it's very impressive, but I'd run a mile from that. I mean, it's a nasty combination there of you know, kind of delicate things. You know, JavaScript is kind of wonky and delicate. Flash is kind of weird. You know, who knows what the licensing might notionally be if you dug into it. And, you know, in contrast to that, suddenly someone says, here's a font file. This is the thing you actually wanted. Now go use it. You know, so that's great. And I think every web designer is rushing with open arms. And therefore, these guys who we've been talking about, these recent graduates, you know, they should be, you know, down with the kids. They should be getting on with it because they're in the same kind of demographic. They've probably got the same desire for exposure. You know, the fact that they have been, you know, churning out typeface designs for the last year rather than kind of monkeying web design or whatever they do, then jump on board nonetheless. You know, the time is here, you know, the place is now, as they say.
Experiments, have you, with that font face, have you seen, are you able to discern or identify the characteristics of letter forms that you think are more successful in this usage, in this space, than other ones might be?
Well, come on. I mean, that's, that the whole joy of typefaces is finding the right one for the job. And I mean, that's why there are thousands of them. Legibility is the obvious determiner, but then all the rest of it is about genre. And one big area which people are sort of, well, not necessarily a big area, but one area that people think may be successful is the use of branding, you know, corporate fonts that have been made for specific clients. And in that case, it really doesn't matter if they're absolute rubbish. You know, if I was the head of, you know, Megacorp and I had my custom font and it was on all my merchandising and all my brochures and everything, and it wasn't on my website, and then someone said, you know, you could have that on your website, I'd want to know why it wasn't on there by 8 a.m. the next morning. You know, why isn't it there? What the hell's going on? You know, are you guys asleep? Right? So, you know, that's one use case. Then we have all the others, and, you know, Let's think about it. What do we do with typefaces? Well, we force text into the foreground. We make it skinny, so you've got to force to read it. We squeeze it. We stretch it out. I mean, you know, you want your online newspapers to have, you know, heavy block headings, don't you? I mean, that won't be legible. It'll just be like, you know, as we expect them. It's just matching the idiom, which is what the web has done. It, as designers gain the upper hand with you know, with CSS, etc., then they've sought to sort of somehow kind of get the quart of printed design into the kind of amorphous pint pot of web pages, and it's an interesting dialogue and it's still going on. So we're going to get that. And there are loads of typefaces which, if you do, you know, if you do roll your own CSS and try them out, then they look really awful. And it's ironic because, you know, they're often really, really nice fonts that have been designed to be very legible in print, particularly under poor conditions, like, you know, being printed very rapidly on poor paper, etc. So you might think that the same kind of conditions would apply on web pages. Well, I don't think it's true. But, you know, with the right line feed and all the rest, maybe they just need to be a bit bigger, or they need a bit of letter spacing, whatever it is. So, you know, it's different, but it's all there to play for. There's no right or wrong answer, I don't think. That's a bit disappointing, isn't it?
Ben, this has been fantastic. Thank you for taking some time out of your day today and chatting about this topic.
Of course. Cool. Thank you very much, Gary. Cheers.